Hello, Elwood Glover introducing Echoes of an Era. And tonight, indeed, it is an end of a sort of era. This is Chapter 10, the final program in a 10-period cycle of Glenn Miller music. And fittingly chosen, we trust, for your enjoyment tonight, previously unissued records by the Glenn Miller Orchestra. These were made by the RCA Victor Company for the Bluebird label, but were never issued at the time, and so their labels are obscure. Even some of the selections may be to you, which may account for the fact that they just were not slated for popularity, and therefore they were set aside and put on a shelf, never to be heard again. But they are, and tonight is the time. And so, previously unissued records by the Glenn Miller Orchestra in our final chapter of the Glenn Miller story. Recorded in August of 1939, My Prayer. The album is titled The Great Dance Bands of the 30s and 40s. This album devoted to the music of Glenn Miller and his orchestra. None of the sides in this album has been previously reissued on LP. In fact, it's the first time that they've been available since their original appearance on the old Bluebird label many, many years ago. This one, even the tune, has probably never been heard of since. It's called Guess I'll Go Back Home. Thank you.
I'll go back home this summer. Should have gone there long ago. I wonder who I'll meet when I walk up Main Street. Who'll yell the first hello? Guess I'll go back home this summer. Mom will cry when I walk in. Brush away a tear as Dad says, "Look who's here. We're glad you're home again." After we've talked of everything, then I'll get a restless spell. I'll walk by the house where she used to live. I hope she married well. Guess I'll go back home this summer. Leave this daily grind behind. There's nothing wrong, I'm sure, that going home won't cure. I'll find my peace of mind.
For those interested in personnel, that would be about the period when the following members of the Glenn Miller Orchestra were in existence. The trombones were three: Miller, Al Mastrin, and Paul Tanner. The trumpets were Clyde Hurley, Lee Knowles, and Dale McMickle. The reeds: Hal McIntyre, Gabe Jelinez, Wilbur Swartz, Tex Beneke, and Al Klink. The rhythm section: Chummy McGregor, Dick Fisher, the guitarist, Roley Bundock, the bass player, Morris Pertle, the drummer. The modern airs were yet to come, but Marion Hutton, Tex Beneke were there, Ray Eberly had yet to join. And if you'd like a little footnote, there is even room for the band boy. He was Bullet's George Durgan, and he's mentioned in full glory. Glenn Miller's Orchestra of October 41. Next, This Is No Laughing Matter.
Time for pretty patter.
while you break my heart. What of all the moon dreams shared together beside a garden wall? Love can always have that perfect weather. A little rain must fall. Think of the dreams you'll shatter if you should say we're through. This is no laughing matter, darling. I'm in love with you.
Speaking of personnels, it's interesting to note that only one saxophone in the five-piece reed section seemed to constantly change. Everything else seemed to remain fairly permanent. Q.P. Swartz, Hal McIntyre, Beneke, and Klink. But that fifth saxophonist, for some reason, it seemed to be a temporary position. Gabe Gelinas, Harold Tennyson, Bill Stegmaier, George Serravo, all seemed to come for short periods of time before Glenn settled on Ernie Casares, who stayed with the band right through to its final date in September of 42, I believe it was, when the band broke up. It's strange that that fifth saxophone seemed to be the precarious position. Glenn Miller's band, the date is 39, and this is something you've perhaps never heard before in this program tonight of previously unheard of Miller performances. Wham, Rebop, Boom, Bam. Thank you. Unissued performances in album form tonight on the Glenn Miller program, Echoes of an Era. Incidentally, for the purists, I better correct a statement made a few records ago when I indicated that Eberle had not yet joined the band when we played a record around 1939. Sorry and apologies. Many months previous to that, Eberle had become a member of the Glenn Miller Orchestra. This is Slow Freight, recorded in March of 1940. Echoes of an Era, Part 10, and the final episode of the Glenn Miller story, heard each weekend night at this time for the past several weeks, recognizing the influence and the tradition that the Glenn Miller music has created in dance band history. I mentioned a few moments ago about several of the fifth saxophonists that seem to constantly change in the Miller-Reed section. Jelinas, Tennyson, Stegmeier, Serravo. There was one other one. In fact, two others. Stan Aronson was one, and a young fellow called Jerry Yelverton. And there's a rather amusing story that George Simon recounts about Yelverton when he came to the band. He was fresh from Auburn College. He was a good jazz clarinetist, but he was rather colorless. He was very bashful. He had the look of a high school physics major who'd worked the lights at a prom, perhaps, to avoid having to ask girls to dance. And he had all the polite manners of a well-reared southern young man. He didn't smoke, he didn't drink. And when he'd get really mad, he'd mutter his most bawdy of swear words, which would come out like Christmas turkey. Well, Jerry sat on the stand between Hal McIntyre and Tex Beneke. And Hal once recounted to George that he and Tex would have a ball simply muttering the filthiest swear words they could think of, just loud enough for Jerry to hear as he was playing solos. And then they'd watch him cringe. Poor Jerry Yelverton was a real gentle soul. He never had a chance. And although Glenn did let him play solo clarinet occasionally, he never received the recognition that perhaps he should have had in the band. Well, now that the story is out, no wonder. He was frightened stiff, sitting between these two experts of profanity, Hal McIntyre and Tex Beneke. This, and again I repeat, these are unissued performances. I don't want people to start writing letters and saying, oh, but I've heard Miller records of these before. It's true, you may have heard other versions of them before, but these are the performances previously unissued until this time that this album came out by RCA Victor. When the Swallows Come Back to Capistrano was a ballad recorded in June of 1940. As the band's popularity grew, so did its recording output. At RCA Victor, Leonard Joy, a former musical conductor and an appreciator of what was good in music, had replaced the admittedly strictly commercial Eli Oberstein. He became so enthused with the Miller band that he wanted to record just about everything in his library. As it was, he settled for a total of 36 sides during the 14 weeks that the band played at the Glen Island. The most successful were either instrumental standards like Pagan Love Song, Isle of Golden Dreams, or the original instrumentals such as Glen's Sold American, or things like Glen Island Special and the famous In the Mood. Many records turned out by Glenn Miller, but not all of them released at that time, certainly not all the versions. Perhaps this one is another of the least known of all Glenn Miller records, not to be confused with a Duke Ellington selection of a similar title. This is called But It Didn't Mean a Thing. Probably one of the most forgettable of all Glenn Miller recordings. You have to accept the fact that everything that Glenn recorded didn't turn out a hit. No, he missed on several things. For example, Harry James had a big instrumental on Cheery Beery Bean. Glenn Miller's version with a Ray Eberly vocal was a flop. Dick Jurgens with Eddie Howard singing scored a smash hit with a song called Careless. Glenn Miller and Ray Eberly's version didn't even cause a ripple. And then there was the Orrin Tucker Orchestra with Wee Bonnie Baker, who made their fame through Oh Johnny Oh, a huge seller. Glenn Miller recorded it with Marion Hutton singing, and for all we know, it's still on the dealer's shelves somewhere, very dusty. And so, you see, even tonight, as we're playing a lot of unissued performances, many of them are, as I said before, forgotten and left on the shelf. Even this one, probably the biggest song over the decades when you consider the popularity of Over the Rainbow, and yet how many of you have Glenn Miller's version of it?
Heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue. And the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me. Where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops, that's where you'll find me. Somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue. Birds fly over the rainbow, why then oh why can't I?
Most of these 1939 records made by the Glenn Miller Orchestra. It's fun to thumb through the December issue, 1939, of Metronome Magazine, where there are a couple of paragraphs that start, "Chalk up March 1st, 1939, as the turning point in Glenn Miller's career. It's his birthday, too, for it was on that afternoon, while he was re-whipping his band into shape in the faithful Haven Studios, that he received word from his bookers that he had been signed for the coming summer season at Glen Island Casino, the spot that makes the bands. Once things started breaking, there was no stopping. Shortly after then, Miller went into the Meadowbrook with 10 air shots a week. The band was beginning to sound beautiful, and there were still a few problems, one of the most serious being drummer problems. In desperation, one night, Glenn called on Mo Pertle, who was now devoting all his time to teaching, to help him out for the evening. Morris got such a boot out of playing with the band that he gave up his pupils and remained with the band until the end. The rhythm was further improved by the addition of a guitar. And, of course, things went on, and history was made. Clyde Hurley was in the band, Dick Fisher, Harold Tennyson, all the greats that we have mentioned so many times throughout this series. And so it's a period of blossoming for the Glenn Miller Orchestra, 1939. It was his final stab at becoming a success. He'd had two tries before that. This was the third time and out. But it wasn't to be. Success was on its way. The Glenn Miller Band of April 39 with The Ladies in Love with You.
Tell me the story and I'll see what I can do.
Well, I got a new gal that's a real killer diller, but I'm not so sure that she goes for Mr. Miller.
That's nothing to worry about. Man, don't you know how to go about finding out?
No, you tell me, Texas.
If there's a gleam in her eye, each time she straightens your tie, you'll know the lady's in love with you. If she can dress for a date without the waiting you hate, it means the lady's in love with you. And when your friends ask you over to join the table, but she picks a faraway booth for two, well, sir, here's just how it stands. You've got romance on your hands because the lady's in love with you.
fast tempo brings up an issue that George often argued with Glenn Miller about, and that is the too fast tempo that he sometimes would beat off. Makes one wonder, I wonder if Glenn Miller ever danced. It may be, you know, that he mightn't have been too good out on the dance floor, and therefore perhaps his tempos were too fast for many occasions. For instance, in that rendition of Ladies in Love with You. I think it was a rather interesting comment made at one time when Simon was arguing with Miller about tempos. When they recorded In the Mood, it was finally agreed between Simon and Miller that that was probably the best dance tempo that a record ever had. As was said at the time, it's not too slow and it's not too fast. It's just half fast, as Louis Armstrong used to announce with a rather lecherous grin. This is Sold American. He recorded this twice, once on the earlier Brunswick label and then again when he went with RCA Victor. And the comment is often drawn as to why Glenn seemed to pick this to keep re-recording it. Sold American was a chant, for those of you who may remember, for the old Lucky Strike radio program. And it could be that Glenn was maybe trying to urge a sponsor to turn an ear his way to take over his band for program material. Who knows? There may have been a commercial possibility behind it. Ironically, though, a few months later, it was Chesterfield who bit and became associated with Glenn for a long period of time. But here's Glenn's Sold American. End of 39, it was interesting to note Glenn Miller's taste in dance orchestras. Whether it's loyalty or musical appreciation, you always found him raving constantly about the rival trombonist's orchestra, the real musical qualities of Tommy Dorsey's band. Miller loved the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, thought it was the ideal dance band of that period. Wouldn't it have been interesting to be able to ask Tommy Dorsey around that time what his favorite band was? 1939 was coming to an end, and everything looked bright for the future. With January of the following year coming up, it looked like a different kind of January for the Glenn Miller Band. Because after a week or so more, at its location at the Meadowbrook spot, it went on another tour and then started the Chesterfield radio shows. It was December 1939, the 27th of December, that those shows started. And about January 5th, they went into the much-coveted location of the Café Rouge of the Hotel Pennsylvania. Glenn Miller was on his way. So we end 10 weeks of Glenn Miller music at this time, 50 minutes just past midnight of this weekend hour. The fanaticism of the Glenn Miller stalwarts sometimes extends beyond anything resembling reality or logic. Simon draws attention to the fact that there are many completely beyond reason claims made by the more fanatic. Like when Glenn died, the whole industry fell apart. Or they were going to change the name of 20th Century Fox Movie Company to 20th Century Miller. Or the Miller Band's broadcasts into Germany were breaking down the morale structure of the Hitler regime. Miller was one of the main reasons for the downfall of Germany. Well, there are the same. There is the Glenn Miller Society, headquartered in England, founded in 1950, which has upheld his name and music throughout the years. Simon does a very fine paragraph, which I'm pleased to make note of here, a most exhaustive report of the original band's activities, was made by John Flower of Toronto, with notable assistance from Pollock and published by Arlington House. Moonlight Serenade reflects better than anything I have ever come across the deep dedication of the true Glenn Miller devotee. We'd like to thank John Flower, too, not only for contributing so much to this program, but for appearing on it on two occasions to contribute his reflection and memory, and also his discography of the Glenn Miller era. Also to Ben Hafey, who contributed those all-too-rare German-directed recordings made by the armed forces during World War II. Thanks to Ron Minhinnett, to Fred Augerman, our producer. Until the next time, when a week from tonight, it'll be Stan Kenton 4142. Now, tomorrow, if you're interested and still around, it's going to be Terry Gibbs, live from the summit, 1961.